Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Episode 2 of The Iron Monarch, a classic marine story by Dennis Bainbridge. Absolute genius. This is episode 2, and we've done the sort of the basic history of it, of this ship designed in Australia, built in Australia, in a time between massive container ships and specialist ships, and at the end of an era of fixing up the Liberty ships that the Americans pumped out into the ocean. So they just pumped out these ships out into the oceans, and basically took their large ships out there and they retrofitted them with gas turbines. These basically, rather than steam, they have actual fuel that burns in them, and gets the fuel to operate properly as a steam, and to have sufficiently low quality fuel, you have all this whole lot of work to make a gas turbine. So it's basically a cheap way of using your fuel, an uncomplicated engine. And he's talked to us so far about the heat exchangers and how the heat exchangers were good and bad, in that they had to, a heat exchanger necessarily had large thermal gradients in it, and large thermal gradients meant that the materials warped and buckled, and there's a whole heap of things like this. But there's a relatively complex but simple thing. You had to really get things up to heat and get them up running first. You just can't just put in that. It's not like an internal combustion engine where you can just get it to spark and it gets up and going. There's a whole series of stages to get it up and going. Well, we're up to page 13. Turbine control systems. The turbine is controlled by a speedtronic control. Figure 11. I haven't seen it, so the next page. Which is three basic functions. Sequencing the pumps, ready to start, stop, sequence, speed relays, ratchet controls, and that's sequencing the control, startup, temperature, speed, nozzle, fuel, power, and pitch, pressure, over speed, over temperature, vibration, loss of flame, vital oil pressures. So this is a bit like the African Queen, but even a bit more crazy. The model used on all marine applications was the Mark II. In fact, I think the control used on the Iron Mark was, and the Iron Duke, was the first production run, as they were different. So these are sister ships. There are five ships built, but the Iron Monarch and the Iron Duke are ways, and the Iron Monarch was the first one. And these are control systems, and this is a huge 1960s style slot computer with slots in it, and you put it, who would know how it works? From the other vessels, as the speedtronic page, figure 12, had two card racks hinged back to back, while the Mark II panels had a single card rack, as shown in figure 12. Yeah, I can't quite see. These are 1960s computer with sort of bird nest wiring and all that type of stuff. The control cards went through some design changes on later panels. Engineers tended to call this panel Fred. Once they set up, they were extremely reliable. Well, yes. It's pretty amazing. This would be rendered in your wristwatch now. This amount of easily... there's more power in my computing power in that little pager down there that I'm reading into. This is the speedtronic controls and a remote annunciator component board, relay panel, terminal board. There's still in the robots that I had, the robot panels had a little relay board, isolation module, bulk power supply, temperature, averaging cabinet, speedtronic page. So the speedtronic page is what they referred to, which is this whole set of racks. Don't quite understand it. Oh dear. A, the annunciator system, which I wonder what that is, which indicated alarms or trip conditions. When the alarm occurred, the indicator light would flash and the alarm bell activated. When reset, the alarm bell would cease and the alarm light would remain in a steady state until the fault was cleared. The power supply was complex, as several sources of main power were available. The ship's AC power, a 125-volt DC power backup is provided. Main turbine horsepower rotor inductor alternator would keep the turbine control operating during the loss of the ship's main power. Well, there you go. Yeah, ships are pretty incredibly complex systems. These sources supply the DC bulk power supply, which then supply the power to the DC regulator panel and generate DC voltages, plus 5.3 DC, 12 volts, minus 12 volts, and plus 28 volts, whatever that was, for use of the Speedtronic page and relay panels. Yeah, and so now you have solid state. At most, you'd have you'd have solid state, but you also have H-bridge, a system of solid state components which act effectively as a high-speed relay. So your motor controls, your robot motor controls, aren't simply your relays are electromagnetic, which pulls a mechanical tab. Then you have the equivalent of a solid-state relay. This is additional information to it. And then the solid-state relay itself has phase problems with AC, DC, you know, AC signals going in. It does all crazy things. So there's a H-bridge rectifier, which is fairly simple. It opens and closes no matter what the voltage is with DC voltage in. So there you go. This Speedtronic ground bus was isolated from the frame ground by a capacitor, which meant that the internal signal floated 5.5 volts above the ship's frame ground. This isolated the Speedtronics and its control devices from external influences. Okay, so it's, now that's interesting. Rather than, we sort of tend to have double grounds, and you would think that the modern day laser labs and labs didn't have problems with grounds, and you do, but it's a different type of problems. It's not the devices don't have to aren't measuring voltages with reference to ground anymore, or the digital stuff. However, you get ground loops. This is if you ground something twice, you can create it as a huge antenna. It's one of those things to go through and understand how things are earthed. So often, if you have got a coaxial cable from one piece of device to the next, you will suddenly introduce noise, and quite scarily, you have to decide which path is a single ground source and whether it's electrically safe. This is high voltage lasers, but let's get back into this. The Speedtronic panel has a ground fault section which would detect any leakages to ground via DC voltage above the ACOM analog common. Again, this is basically, you can basically do a counting of your voltages and work out whether your voltage is going through a person or something like that. It's not used. The Speedtronic, which is part of the safety systems, and you really essentially, if you're building a big project, a big robotics project or big factory, you can essentially safety can actually take over, so you can make everything independently safe, which is, there's nothing problem with safety, independently safe, and then the linkages between the safe things, blah, blah, blah. Or what I tended to do is put in a complete layer of independent safety systems, which would go in back to a central safety computer, which could overlock and decide with complicated to describe. It's just that if you have independent things which are independently safe, it's much better to have an external safety thing. So I had an independent computer checking the safety of my robotics lab, or my robotics factory. And that was, and you could, it was just very, very safe. Well, I thought it was very safe. Okay. The temperature averaging module mounted on the door was used to average the readings of the 12 exhaust thermocouples to gain one reading for use by the control system. Switches were provided by each of the 12 control thermocouples and four trip thermocouples. They could read individually or on the main temperature meter, or isolated if the problem that could be reflected could affect the average. Okay, and now this nowadays is all handled in a chip. So the 12 thermocouples, I think I have in my utility belt for students. I have four independent thermocouples and a bank of eight thermocouples in series to give very high precision as a unit of thermocouples. Nowadays, thermocouples are so cheap, and you would tend to, depending on what you want to do, this is all very high temperature stuff. Okay, I'll just read through. So there's a lot of interesting stuff for me who is building robotics factories and also these new classroom situations. Oh, classroom modules, teaching modules. The isolation filter and module contained filter cards to receive high voltage extended signals and condition them to use in the panel, which is sort of like your preamp or your stuff. On the front of the device, nowadays, because everything is digitized, you do everything Wi-Fi, I suppose. I wonder what it would be like in a military vessel. Okay. On the front door of the devices include meters for VCE, fuel control voltage, HP and LP speed, second stage nozzle position and temperature. The indicators lights were provided to indicate flame at various speeds and set points which control was currently active in controlling the turbine, ready to start the complete sequence status. A master control was provided which could control how far the start sequence would be allowed to progress. Settings were crank, fire and auto. A thermocouple is a temperature meter. It's two wires of different alloys, and it's a quantum mechanical effect, which means that the voltage back at your end will indicate the voltage, the temperature at the other end of the thermocouples. But they are very sensitive things to do. Can you imagine in a marine environment, you set it up and go, oh dear. A thermocouple switch provided to select various turbine temperature points to read out on the temperature meter. This all be handled real-time in software, and because your software there, you could have several parallel computers doing the same tasks from the same measurements. So you'd have like a mesh of detectors, a mesh of CPUs, and then oversight CPUs, oversight for safety, oversight for performance, oversight system, a system CPU. CPUs are so cheap now that they cost a couple of cents each to do. So that's an amazing thing to go across. This is how I will produce it now, but you just need time and design team to do it. The speedtronic control will vary depending on the application. In Australia, three different systems to use. So speedtronic control is really basically an industrial computer. An industrial Okay, mechanical drive with CPP propeller, BHP. Electric drive using DC motors with fixed pitch propellers, Seaways. Electric drive using AC motors and CP propellers, Union Steamships of New Zealand. Well, there you go. And you can imagine how much control you have, how much joy it is then, all the system across. You have a power plant which produces voltage, and that voltage is applied to motors. It's incredibly simple system to control, the modern diesel locomotive. Okay, now here's a fairly complex system they're showing here. A temperature control, speed control, startup program control, power control, fuel controls, all different things putting through, and lights to show you what's going. A function generator, my godfather. So all this stuff would be, and then it eventually goes to propeller and nozzles. Pitch position, hydraulic systems to put it. So this is like, these are incredible systems. It's amazing what's going through. Okay, in figure 13 we show a block diagram, and can I say there's about 20 little different docks, the feedback loops and cross loops and various signals across here, all beautifully wired, all beautifully had to be designed. Nowadays, now the cost of electronics is so low, it'd be done differently. We show a block diagram of the mechanical drive and CCP propeller. I don't know what CPP, something pitch propeller. The fuel signal VCE has a maximum value of 10 volts DCE and will always be trying to maintain this level. The control loops each have a diode with an anode connected to the VCE. The control loop, which the lowest voltage will act as a minimum value gate to hold the VCE control. Oh, that's interesting. There is a diode diagram here. Now, the diode diagram is aligned with a point because the diodes used to be a flat crystal and a needle pointing down. So they mechanically, they've got part of computing done by this diode, which gives you, you know, microsecond control. You suddenly, you need this stuff. So they've got four parallel control systems, and one which is putting out this highest voltage will put it through. There you go, you can see. As VCE increases its values, it means the turbine requires more fuel, so the bypass valve is closed to force the fuel flow through the flow divider, which supplies the measured amount of fuel per revolution to the combustion fuel nozzles. The flow divider was toothed wheel. You can imagine, it's all mechanical, there's no opto electronics, because you'd have heaps of different things, like magnetic reed switches, all this technology is thing. This signal was also used to power control feedback for the fuel control loop. Startup control is open loop with the VCE levels to fire warm acceleration are pre-adjusted to maintain constant unless certain site conditions need a small change. You can imagine in a warship, a US warship, imagine a US aircraft carrier. And of course, I shudder to think what the Yanks are doing with their nuclear powered stuff. Speed control model, like there's just after World War II, they had nuclear powered aircraft carriers, you know, huge, massive things. How stupid that would be, how dangerous it would be. Speed control monitors and the turbine speed. Each turbine motor had 60 tooth wheel, which activates magnetic pickups. Okay, so that makes sense. So 60-tooth wheel speeds up. The speed pulses were converted to 100 volts DC signals for rated speed. So we would put it on a serial bus nowadays, and it would just report itself. The HP rotor speed was held at 50% shaft disc brake is set. In normal operations, HP rotor speed is controlled between 80 and 14 Hs. I don't know what that means. hertz, I suppose, 100% by position of the second stage nozzles. Now, this is amazing because this book is beautifully written. It's got beautiful sections to it, but only people who are technically into it. It would be complete gibbledygook to, say, someone who spent their life pottering around the garden. The LP rotor speed control is used in leading the governor at the speed exceeds 102% by reducing the fuel. So a governor is like the old... it still had a mechanical speed. A governor is one of those centripetal two little balls on hinges which fly out and spin out, and they, as they fly outwards, they lift up a valve. Isn't that beautiful? When operating in at sea mode, the LP motor speed was controlled at 100% by modulating propeller pitch. This allowed the shaft-driven alternator to maintain a constant system frequency. So what happened is that it would be at an optimum speed, and if it needed more power, it's like the modern lighting systems, modern accelerators, modern... And it's GE, so they would be seeing this as a form of a parasitic power station. Basically, they've got a power station at sea, and so the power is going out by varying the pitch of the propellers. Now, you obviously can't have variable pitch propellers in stealth machines, because variable pitch and noise, this would have made a huge amount of sea noise. It would be sound polluting as well. A preset acceleration control prevents either the rotor from exceeding speed acceleration of 1% per second. If the rate has exceeded, the VCE is dipped to slow down the rate. So this is all mechanical stuff. If I can say, this is not unusual in your robot arms. They have feedback to stop over acceleration. This is interesting. You can get the third derivative. You can control the third derivative. So this is a form of controlling the third derivative. Derivative, so in robotics, when your arm comes up, it basically takes the shutter out of the whole thing. So this is beautiful. This ship would have gone forward, up and down with no shutter. So nowadays, all you do in your AUB industrial robots is you set the third derivative down. Imagine I'm retired, or medically retired, shut off for various stupid reasons, and all this knowledge has been locked and lost away. Temperature control is very important, as it's needed to protect the turbine from thermal stress and to control the firing temperature. As explained before, the second stage nozzles are modulated to control the exhaust temperature. When the HP rotor has reached 100% speed and control has reached limit, if the load is there, for the fuel has increased further, then the temperature control takes over controlling the VCE, so the exhaust temperature maximum limit is not exceeded. This means the machine is fully loaded. If any increase in temperature was allowed, the machine components would be ruined. This is a critical setting. I don't know if people know, in aircraft and ships, military ships, they've got war emergency power. So they've got a thing to actually get the ship, so it lives its entire lifetime, or if the ship is in the shit and its lifetime is no longer on the cards, a torpedo is going on it, it can actually get 10% war emergency power. Of course, the Russians don't care about that type of... I know of Russian helicopter pilots who regularly just want a little boost and keep on dipping on their war emergency power, so you can override all of this for a short time in a war emergency setting. As the firing temperature cannot be physically measured, other methods must be used to measure the ambient effect The compressor discharge air pressure transducer output is used to generate an ambient bias signal. In colder weather, the air is more dense, so the airflow will increase, and the increased airflow will tend to lower the exhaust temperature. The temperature control kept the same control setting in the controller, the internal design and firing temperature would be incorrect. The ambient bias temperature is used in the temperature control to lower the minimum allowed set point. As the pressure bias increases, the temperature set point decreases. Again, what these people are doing is point by point conservative stuff. There's stuff with all these parameters, air temperature, engine temperature, that stuff, and things you can't measure. You let them vary in a range and get a frontier and measure the one parameter versus the frontier. So you may adjust one thing, and the other ones vary, and that will produce a curve, a frontier curve, measure across. I haven't explained that very well. Some marine systems have special power and pitch controls added to the control system. The power control has two sections. The SPA power program module takes the bridge or engine room propulsion lever level absolute signal generated by a potentiometer located on the lever. So this is basically a wire on a variable resistor to go down a potentiometer. As the speed of the ship to be linear with the lever position, a cubic generator is required to power the required cube of the ship's speed. Okay, now just to try and get you, the thing is that flow resistance of an object in a flow rate, right, is proportional to V squared. Drag is proportional to V squared, but in a liquid it tends to be proportional to V cubed, and this is all the basic force on a ship is proportional to V cubed. So if you halve a ship's time, you will reduce the fuel it takes by a factor of 8 to get there, but then it takes twice as long to get there. So the overall fuel drops by, what is it, or half, let's see, by a quarter, even though you've taken twice as long to get there, because it's a cube. So it is significant. Like, if we could slow down shipping, we could reduce the greenhouse gas and the energy component of fuel. We at the moment we have just got this thing where we want to ship at a particular speed. Okay. So especially now, Australia now has a lot of our fuel supply is at sea. So we get 90% of our petroleum from overseas, despite being a dry continent and not having the conditions for making a lot of fuel. And like, if we slow things down, it's much better to have the fuel stored at sea rather than have the fuel come really quickly and then storing it here and then paying for the extra amount of storage. It also means there's a sort of amount of flexibility that, you know, the fuel can be at sea and people can bid for it as it goes out to sea. And it also gets these mega large processing plants. It is also interesting sort of how people, you know, whether you process the fuel on land and filter it up and then produce much cleaner exposure. Okay, the feedback from the fuel flow divider speeds the pickup. So you've got a cube generator. Isn't that beautiful? A cubic sense. And that would be a line of LabVIEW code. The important thing is that there was no code written for this. There is no computer. It's an industrial control with no computer. Ah, shit. And there are three modes of operation: docking, manoeuvre, at sea. So you can, in docking mode, only distillate fuel may be used to clear the fuel line. You can imagine that. Imagine import the producers, and it's interesting to know that the amount of pollution increases as you go out to sea. There are different fuel rates for manoeuvre at sea modes. The commanded rate required to provide idle fuel is higher at sea mode to allow control of the propeller, control 100% of the speed shaft alternator. The torque limiter provides protection for the LP rotor if the speed is low and to prevent the torque exceeding the set limit. Power control to VC is overridden at any time by the temperature or speed control if the LP tries to exceed 102% of the rated speed. It is interesting, so that's why they've got diodes. So you can imagine the diode would fail. I wonder if these would be these wouldn't be sold. These would be actual physical glass tube diodes. I bet they would be. Pitch control, mode 72 here. It would have been designed 60s, yeah, it would have been glass. Pitch control modulates the pitch of the propeller to reflect the position and propulsion lever. So this is all to give this sensation of forward and back. Docking and manoeuvre mode, pitch tracks, lever open position, push forward, the pitch in full 50% position. The at-sea mode, the pitch is changed to provide the LP rotor speed control to maintain 125 revolutions per minute on the main shaft and maintain the shaft alternating frequency. The control will maintain this state during full ahead or full stern operations. The electric drive ships, both DC and AC, had slight variations in the speedtronic control. The Seaway ships using DC motors were similar to standard generator drive controls, while the United Steamships Trans-Tasman Ro-Ro ships used twin AC motor drives and CP propellers in the form of power control to pitch control. Amazing. Speedtronic panel has a series of protection functions to prevent the turbine damage. The master project unit, if all conditions are well, generate the four signal, which when true allows the turbine to run. If the master control project sends a signal indicating the fault, will disable the four relay, which is immediately trips the turbine by dumping the control oil pressure. Okay, well this is interesting. Nowadays people don't even know binary logic. So this is pre-computer code. Computer code would be binary logic, and I don't think people understand binary. Trip items include LP and HP rotor overspeed, over temperature, loss of flame, vibration, low oil pressure, excess fuel. It should be noted that ship's engineers often made the comment that the turbine safety was placed before the ship's safety. This is a difficult problem to resolve, as it's impossible to keep running the turbine if it's lost the flame or lube oil. The overspeed speedtronics is supplemented by overspeed bolts on each rotor. Over temperature and vibration could be a possibility for override in a dangerous situation, and the ship may be saved at the cost of turbine damage, which is sort of what I was talking about, war emergency. So this is a deep engineering. This is engineering when the engineers had physical things to do and they had to actually think full. Each line of code would be a complete bulky mechanical system. So, manual emergency control. In case of complete failure of the speedtronic control, a manual emergency control was provided in the turbine base, which allowed the ship to be run at reduced power level. Exhaust temperature was restricted to 600 degrees Fahrenheit. It was used once on the GTV Iron Monarch to achieve a speed of 10 knots. And this is what I was talking about, of having they essentially did what I had in the factory, in robotics factories, multiple mesh CPU. Okay, that was chapter one. I'm glad we got the area that Dennis is most involved in, which was the speed turbines and engineers. And you can imagine that this ship took 100 people. I can't believe the number of engineers involved. Birth of a concept ship. BHP was born in Broken Hill, New South Wales, with the discovery of the Charles Rasp in 1883, a site he thought to be rich in tin. It was silver and lead that assayed in the area led to the formation of BHP Company. In August 1885, from these small beginnings, BHP is now Australia's largest company. It's steel, mining, oil, gas interests. With steelworks in Newcastle, Port Kembla, Whyalla, a rolling mill in Kwana, iron ore deposits, an iron knob, the iron mark, and Yempi Sound, shipping became an important aspect of the company's business. That's when it decided it was, when it was an Australian iron producing thing. So it's like America, it's a rust belt. We haven't wanted a rust belt, we've just sold it off for scrap before it could rust. A shipyard was established in Whyalla, SA, and called the Whyalla Shipbuilding Engineering Works. They completed their first carrier ship, the Iron Monarch II, in April. Oh, so Iron Monarch in April 43, and the Iron Duke in August 1943 for the BHP Company. 43? What? So these were built in 43? World War II ships? The distribution of his steel products between works and capital city distribution points was important to keep the pressure on rail and shipping freight rates. An integrated system was planned using two specialised steel products, ro-ro ships. Shipping, what ro-ro means, I don't know. Shipping steel products was conventional ships was expensive, time-consuming, and keeping control of small customer lots was difficult. The current methods were ripe for modernization. Okay, so you can imagine just shit breaking out in World War II, and we had to get desperate. Australia was in desperate shit in World War II. I just can't describe it. We were just planning to blow up bridges, building factories in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. Down the shit. The problems were: A, rail and conventional shipping was slow and subject to damage. The time required to load and unload 10,000 tons of steel onto a conventional ship with cranes was 5 days and longer at some berths, having to use the ship's derricks restricted it to 5-ton lift. The concept ship would load 11,000 tons in 30 hours, sail to Melbourne a day later. Steel rusts quickly when wet, is heavy and difficult to stow, and longer lengths can bend easily. Conventional shipping methods were prone to damage. Steel is difficult to stow, and if not stowed correctly, or hatch cover leaked at sea, the damage could be resolved. With rail, steel was in the open rain for dust and damage. The length of a ship, length of time a ship is in port incurs port charges, towage costs as considered. The story of how the concept evolved was described as followed. From 1957, Bob McLennan was appointed Chief Officer Shipping at Newcastle. Under Bill Sweetland's shipping manager, Bob McLennan's first task was to reorganised movements of finished products from the finishing end and rolling mills to the customers in Melbourne and Adelaide. Steel products were moved in the ships between 8,000 and 2,000 dead weights fitted to ship's gear were slow to both load and unload with sling loads of 2 to 3 tons. You can imagine that. These cranes just wouldn't be big enough. Okay, so we've got that. This is real dramatic stuff. BHP had, at this time, started to fit 10-ton luffing crane to the wharves The task given to Bob McLennan was to develop a movement of 10-ton pre-slung loads from the mills to the customer. About 10,000 suitable slings were developed by Rylance at Wire Rope Works. At the end, I fixed and patented tellurite fittings. Yeah, tellurite sounds interesting. I wish I could understand it. A complete sling handling system was put in place. This greatly increased the ship's loading rate and made efficient use of the capacity of wharf cranes. In 1963, Bob McLennan was transferred to the company's head office in Melbourne to the position of shipping manager, with Bill Shidlin, general manager, engineering shipping. As part of the overall fleet review, Bob McLennan was sent overseas to study transport management at Stanford University. The Masterson Line container trade out of San Francisco, tug and barge operations the US West Coast out of Vancouver, Canada, and used computers to program the cargo ship movements to create greater efficiency and reduce costs. The old ship's gear, small ships, had to be replaced, and development team with Captain P. Brady, Marine Superintendent, and Jim McGreechy, Superintendent Engineer, and Ross Stacey, Wireless Shipyard, met in Melbourne under Bob McLennan to draft a proposal to be put to the company. The result was the layout of a concept that was the committee considered worthy of development. The proposals were accepted. So the Iron Duke and Iron Maiden were from 1943. I don't understand this. The result was the layout of the concept these committees considered worthy of development. The proposals were accepted, enabling the development of a complete specification designed to cover the ship's power unit, cargo handling, stevedoring, manning numbers, and operational manners. A number of subcommittees were set up to handle detailed specifications, which had the following requirements: to deliver products from Port Kembla to Melbourne, Adelaide, Whyalla, and Whyalla to Melbourne, to New South Wales on at least once a week basis or better; to enable the vessel to be controlled in all aspects of handling and berthing by the master from the bridge in a similar fashion to an airline's pilot's capability; to be loaded through the stern door by straddle carriers lifting at least 30 tons and gaining access to the vessels via the stern ramp; to investigate the use of industrial gas turbines as a primary power source with a controllable pitch propeller assisted for handling and berthing of the bow thruster; cargo to be unitized into bolsters using standard container fittings; ship's hulls to be serviced by overhead cranes with hulls capable of accepting steel lengths of up to 60 feet, whilst longer lengths, such as rails from Whyalla, will be stowed on the crane deck. The system concept was the most innovative ship designed ever seen in Australia, and in fact, in some aspects, the first in the world. The vessel had to be fast to compete with rail, and the design had to be sleek, bow, stern, underwater shape, which was tank tested to prove the design. Of course, you don't have the bulbs thing. This is no computers involved in here whatsoever, mate. We just have this person has a sense of what it was. To improve the life, the hull was painted with a new Dermot inorganic zinc paint system developed in the USA, and they set up a branch on Whyalla. The sections were blasted and treated before being installed on the ship. The paint finish proved to be the main reason for the hull life of the Iron Monarch. That one is great. In addition to the above, these committees added further requirements to the list below: the ability to berth and unberth with a minimum of tug assist, propulsion and power generation to be controlled from the bridge, completely unmanned engine room while at sea mode, reduced engineering manning as qualified shore staff to assist with maintenance, power from shaft alternator, oh, there you go, flame tank stabilisation to reduce racking stress on the hull, cargo containment vessel. The system was a brown passive roll tank from British Shipbuilding. Complete the system with new distribution facilities, bolsters to hold the steel products, and straddle the carriers to trundle the bolsters on and off the vessel. Bosses selected were similar to ISO International Standards Organization standard half-height containers, in standard 20 foot long by 8 foot wide, 10 foot deep. The ends were hinged to allow overhang sections of up to 80 feet were carried to the vehicle deck. Tarps were used to prevent water damage of the steel products. Three 33-ton capacity straddle trucks were carried onto the ship to be used for loading and unloading. The bolsters, the vehicle deck were up to 33-ton gantry cranes, then took over with the ability for long travel. The entire length of the vehicle deck could lower cargo into the appropriate cell guided bays. The bolsters are stacked six high in lower holds and three high on the vehicle decks. An angle Navier, N-A-V-R-E, stern ramp, number 7 of this internationally used design, used to allow loading from conventional wharf. The ramp is 60 foot long and hinged in the middle, supported by two side frames. A 100-ton self-tensioning winch takes the weight of the ramp. The height of the side of the wharf is controlled from a sensor arm inboard side frame of the ramp. Hydraulic winches are mounted on the side of frames to position the hinged section of the ramp, that the wharf load is 5 to 10 tons. When fully loaded, the straddle trucks on the ramp load 70 tons, which is evenly distributed over the wharf. I'm surprised no one got killed in this. We had other engineering projects in Australia at this time, and there's always a casualty. Oh my God, Father. The Ro-Ro loading arrangement concept. So I don't know. I don't know quite how it goes, but the actual. Yeah, so they've got a Ro-Ro, and it's the actual. The doors on the side of the ship coming in. The requirement for vehicle access from the ramp meant that. Meant the allocated space for the engine room had to comply with one of two options. Medium speed diesel gas turbine. The gas turbine is superior power to weight ratio was selected based on the successful trial of the John Sargent on residual fuel. The prospect of using Gippsland waxy crude oil, a refinery byproduct costing $16 per ton, was also attractive. At the room temperature, this oil solidified, so required a heating. Solid oil. Oh. In Gippsland, I think they've shut all that down. This was a good fuel, low in vanadium, however, high in sodium, which could be removed by washing. Well, there you go. Why is vanadium a problem? High in sodium could be removed by washing. Typical properties were sulfur 0.41%. Vanadium, nickel, and iron, salt. So vanadium is a problem. Vanadium is a problem in fuel. Who would have thought? I don't understand why. Late in 1966, Bob McLennan and Jim McLeachy visited GE Gas Turbine Department in Schenectady, New York, to discuss and inspect production of the proposed 19,000 SHP gas turbines and laid the foundation for a later team of marine engineers to oversee production and learn the operating technologies needed to manage the system in practice. And all this, we want a star picket. Out of all this, you get a star picket which goes into someone's farm and they want to spend $6 or $12 on how it all operated. I don't understand. On the return, the design incorporated a gas turbine was confirmed. The Whaler Shipyard was able in 1968 to lay out the general arrangement drawings and incorporated the results of various committee findings. A more detailed proposal was developed in 1969. Bob McLennan was the shipping manager, presented a complete proposal to John Sweetland prior to the BHP board approval. Many questions arose which resulted from Bob McLennan's personally building a 5-foot 6-inch model to illustrate the system of the board members' management. The concept was approved by the HP board in 1970. The total project was $32 million, of which the ship's portion was $24 million. The model McCullum made due to shipyard being on top budget differed in some aspects to the final design, as it incorporated four decks hatches, which were thought to be of value if there was a failure of the ramp of gantry cranes. Photographs of the models appear in McCullum's appendix article. I must say, I was impressed when I saw the photographs of the model, which now sits under Bob's house. Well, there you go. Poor Bob. I hope it's still there. In the USA winter of 71-72, Reg Jones and Vince Klass went to GE Snadaki to cover GE production systems. During the visit, Reg Jones' enthusiasm for skiing resulted in a trip to Vermont with GE's Bill Hefner. They tried a tough run before deciding to move on to an easier run, however. Reg had a fall and suffered a broken leg, which put him out of action for 6 weeks. He stayed with Hefner's and he could travel. When he could travel, he was taken in a G plane to New York for his trip home. G responded by instructing staff where it would be no more customer ski trips. There you go. G did a lot of work with the system and its control. Bill Rowan and Don Rexford simulated the ship's operations, taking in all factors, including turbine, hull, propeller. This simulation was based on the final controller designs. The turbine was designed to fit the package into the space available. Due to the plant length, the accessory skid had to be shortened by building it on two levels. In Figure 15, the longitudinal section of the engine room showing the end-to-end dimensions of the turbine gear is 58 feet 4 inches, a total weight of 175 tons. The transverse section is 16, shows the layout and combustion piping, generators and heat recovery system. Each generator would have positioned an early cull vibration. So this is all... So many people, so few computers, they just, you know, this is before the age of silicon. Oh my god. It just looks like a normal ship, everybody. But it's got a huge engine room hold. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. I don't know where hold one is, but it's all low down. Auxiliary power was provided by 3 Allen diesel sets. 625 kilovolt amps, huge things. The unit's operations are programmed by Siemens panels. The 625 and 765 kVA sets were parallel to provide the ship's base power when required, the gas turbine starting model. Now, it's really interesting that if you see they have sort of an exhaust, in some of the plans, exhaust out the tail. And that's a little electrics generator. They don't have a battery on an aircraft. They've got a little fuel power generator. The 1,750 kVA set is programmed to be taken offload, ready to use the blow bow thrusters motors. During cargo operations, it used a cargo area venting fans, 625 kVA units, was air-cooled and installed away from the engine room. When at sea, when switched to at sea mode, the ship's power load was taken over by the shaft-driven alternator. The alternator will also double as a take-home motor powered by diesel sets. Experience later would prove that this automatic switch over the shaft alternator couldn't be relied on 100%, so it was often performed manually. The problem was thought to be different droop characteristics between sets. However, I was told in the 1980s a frequency fault was found in the control, which was there from the start and not found. Well, there you go. The exhaust heat extraction system was shown in figure 18. Heat recovery units are located to collect the heat from the port and starboard gas turbine regenerator outlets number 1 and number 2 diesel sets. Using the Esotherm 500 as a main heat transfer fluid to heat the fuel and domestic water. The system, you have a hot shower. Well, this is a pretty amazing thing. And you wouldn't, this is all based on someone, no computer modelling, just ships of a certain shape, should be a certain shape. But it is interesting that you've got the stern doors at an angle at the back here. Okay. The system design for year 18 was for fuel ships water heating. The gas turbine regenerator exhausted at 594 degrees Fahrenheit to the exact to extract some strange number of BTUs per hour. The diesel exhaust could contribute a million BTUR recovery to the exhaust temperature. The Esotherm fluid temperature was controlled to 400 degrees Fahrenheit by using bypass valve in the regenerator system. A minimum flow was allowed through the exchangers for safety. The diesel units are controlled by bypassing the exhaust gas. The system's operation was automatic with the main and peaking pumps programmed from the starting and stopping gas turbine, the diesel seats. When the diesels were running, and peaking pump output was diverted through the auxiliary system supplying the fuel oil heater. Heating surfaces were calculated to be on top of the heating requirement for the waxy residual oil. There was 3,300 feet of heating surface for 1,000 tons of residual fuel. So this is just rubbish fuel, isn't it? Get on this. I'm on page 8. I'll just go over here. You've got the control system here. A few diodes and switches and heating things. Calorifer, heat exchanger, fuel oil heater. Different parts in here. The fresh water cooling system is designed for cooling the gas turbine, diesel generators, air conditioning and refrigeration, ramp hydraulic oil and heat exchanger. Pump land sealed. Sea water cools the fresh water in two plate heat exchangers in parallel, designed for sea water temperature of 18 degrees Fahrenheit, with a fresh water outlet at 95 degrees Fahrenheit. One cooler is shut off in port with sea water temperature of 85 degrees, so the satisfactory plate flow rate for the thermal duty may be obtained. I don't quite understand it. We're up onto page 29, getting on to the fuel treatment plant. So amazing, in all that technical jargon, there is someone who goes skiing and breaks his leg. Isn't it amazing? Can you imagine 1963? All that type of stuff. It'll be quite interesting. And the world without computers, the world without mobile phones. Just an amazing story. So reading through here, roughly an hour. Thanks for listening. Another Dennis Bainbridge miracle stuff. We're up to page 29, just to give you a look. The book is, it's more than 100 pages to go of this book. I'm actually going to go power through this book. I don't care how bored you are overseas. We wanted to build a ship. We had to build a ship. We had a steel industry. We didn't read the signs on what is that big country up in Korea doing. And essentially, we just have talked ourselves out of doing so much. I think we're just a population too far from the action. It's all done in China. Well, I hope you enjoy it. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. may you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.